This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
This is the seminar by Ken Myers on Tuesday afternoon.
So I've been redefining it and reshaping it up until early this morning to figure out exactly what to focus on. Someone once said that I had the gift of bibliography, or more particularly the gift of underlining, and that's basically what I'm going to be exercising today in offering some reading suggestions that I think will help understand the context, the cultural context in which we're we might strive to pursue human flourishing, to promote it. I was nervous until yesterday morning that the readings that I was going to suggest might seem a bit abstruse to people here, and then I heard the first 10 minutes of N.T. Wright's presentation, in which, not that it was more abstruse than what I'm going to do, but actually consider the recommendations I give you here as footnotes to the first 10 minutes of his talk yesterday on where are we as a culture. If we're at a point of crisis in some sense, if we're at a point of decision-making, point where judgment is necessary and a path is going to be chosen. What's the trajectory that brought us to this point? How did we get here? And that's part of what I want to offer some suggestions on readings that that have helped me formulate an account of how we got here. I want to start by stressing the fact that human flourishing is not an individual experience. It's a social and communal and cultural condition. I think that we run the risk, as modern / postmodern / hypermodern people, of thinking of human flourishing as personal, in terms of personal fulfillment. But human flourishing, I think, is better understood as a social or communal cultural condition, and it's therefore enabled or deterred by cultural elements that have a trajectory, that have a momentum. Culture is something that exists in history. It has to be understood in terms of its trajectory. And I think then if we're to address the cultural impediments to or opportunities for human flourishing, we need to develop an understanding of how cultural forms have taken shape and how other cultural forms might take shape. I make a living by trying to find books that assist such an understanding, and I've been asked to share some of those books today. And as I list these, I'll make a few comments about how the analysis in the books might help us think and act in the interest of human flourishing. Human flourishing is, after all, communal. It involves a pattern of our engagement with each other and with the rest of creation, and how our practices and cultural institutions reflect and honor the reality of creation, of human nature, and of the Creator. As I've studied and read and talked to many people over the course of the last 20 years, I've realized more and more how our posture towards creation is one of the most central defining features of a culture. It's the conviction of many of the authors that I'll mention that the era we call modernity introduced destructive and dehumanizing presuppositions and practices about our orientation within creation. Human flourishing is communal. So somewhere in our thinking about this subject, we need to think about the shape of life in local churches. The church is a pilot program of a new humanity. N.T. Wright reminded us yesterday. It's a humanity whose shared life is necessarily liturgical and sacramental, and so a commitment to human flourishing should guide the practices of local Christian communities. One person who's written perceptively about this, as well as acted perceptively, is Eugene Peterson, who's observed many times and in many ways that the mission of the church and of each local expression of the church commits us to abundant life in a setting in which life is short-changed. Here's a quote from his 2005 book, Christ Plays in 10,000 Places. Can you read that all right in the back? I didn't test to see if the lighting and everything works back there. I worry, however, that many Christians are indifferent to the ways our cultural status quo is dehumanizing. We tend to accept many of the practices and assumptions of our post-Christian neighbors. As long as we can worship freely in a way that we deem appropriate, we don't generally raise many questions about the adequacy of the way of life that's sustained by dominant cultural institutions, unless we see that a commandment's being broken. I think that if we're committed to promoting human flourishing, we need to know what cultural currents we have to swim against. We need to be aware of the source and the strength and the depth of those currents, how they flow not just in the institutions and sensibilities of modern life, but in our own habits of heart and mind and body, in our deepest consciousness, in what Richard Weaver calls our metaphysical dream of the world, what we intuitively sense reality is like before we start theorizing about it. I'm going to add a footnote here. I've used the word modern and postmodern without going into a lot of discussion about the nature of the postmodern, but I tend to think that Anthony Giddens and a number of other social thinkers are correct when they say that whatever postmodern means, it's really hypermodern. It's more of the same, only with a different set of emphases, that it's not getting over modernity, it's reinforcing, or as Giddens says, universalizing and intensifying certain aspects of modernity at the expense of others. And so don't fret if I say the word modern and say, you don't sit there thinking, oh yes, but we're not modern anymore. Well, we can talk, have that discussion later. But so when I say modern, that's shorthand for modern / hypermodern or postmodern. Human flourishing will not be increased simply by promoting appropriate attitude adjustments while ignoring structural, institutional, and systemic barriers to human flourishing. Human flourishing is a lived condition, not a set of insights for living. And in order to understand the systemic disordering forces that work against human flourishing, I think we need a certain detachment from culture, which is very difficult. It's a bit like being a fish asked to describe what wet feels like. So it's always hard to get some detachment from your culture to understand its presuppositions because you share them. But it's particularly hard, I think, for evangelical Christians, for reasons I want to describe here. First of all,
can you go back to that slide?
I can. Yep. This is obviously an overgeneralization, but a lot of good analysis involves good generalizations. My sense is that evangelicals, rigorous historically grounded cultural criticism isn't something you meet on the street anyway. I mean, it's not something that. But I think that we have a particular resistance to it for some reasons that are particular in our tradition. And one of them is this dualistic tendency that has been alluded to already, that we tend to think of salvation as a way of getting away from the disorders of our culture, or getting out of culture. But also, we really like timeless truths. We're not as comfortable with the idea that knowledge is historically embedded. And so the way we understand reality is historically embedded. We try to get away from history entirely and search for timeless truths. And so we're always looking for perpetually or perennially true insights about reality. We're much more interested in those than we are insights about some historical particularity. But I don't think that we, obviously timeless truths are important, but I don't think we can understand how a people in a particular time and place live with those timeless truths unless we give some attention to historical particularity. Second, as evangelicals, we're practical. We like solutions. This is part of our American heritage. I think Mark Knowles was who said that for evangelicals, the procedure is ready, fire, aim. We like to get to the solution and to describe a condition or a state of affairs for which there's not an evident solution is very unattractive. I've had this happen to me where I've described or used someone else's description of some cultural disorder, and people say, well, what can we do about it? As if the fact that I don't know what we can do about it, and maybe nobody knows what we can do about it, is an indication that it's not a problem. It's like saying we can't cure cancer, so it's not a disease. Okay? A lot of cultural conditions are deep, tragic problems that we may not have a solution for. And again, our disposition to finding answers, particularly in a hurry, is something that deters us from this kind of thinking. Also, we're more at home with personal and relational dynamics than we are with institutional and formal mechanisms of meaning. And so we tend to think that how people feel and think and act individually matters a lot more than institutional structures. And we don't realize the extent to which the repertoire or vocabulary of action and ideas that individuals have has been in significant ways conditioned by the formal considerations that they're intermeshed in. Fourth, because of our evangelistic imperative, I think, and I think this is true, I know this has been true in my own experience, and I've talked to others. We're nervous that a radical critique of the culture embraced by our colleagues will be an obstacle to winsome evangelism. We don't want to look too cranky because then people won't like Jesus. If we display how radical the gospel is, that it's going to cause radical changes in people's lives. People who aren't looking for radical changes, but who are looking for a spirituality module that they can append to their existing lives, then an effort to come to some radical critique of the state of our culture might make us nervous. Well, as N.T. Wright said yesterday morning, we are at a historical threshold moment. It seems to many people, and so we have to be willing to ask some deep questions about how we got here. And then lastly, I won't describe this. I think at some level we still do have a sense that religion is private, not public. We're not entirely convinced that it has public consequences. In this sense, we're good Americans. I mean, in a sense, a lot of evangelicals practice a religion that the ACLU would love. We're dualists who aren't convinced that there's going to be some remarkable public consequence of the reality of Christ and his work. So, in order to introduce you to this a framework of understanding how we got here, I asked the person who invited me here, well, how many books can I recommend? I mean, how long can the list be? And we went around, well, could it be this big? And then finally they said, well, just do what you want. So I thought I'll start easy. I'll start easy with five essays. We won't even get to books yet. Five essays, particularly if charity begins at home, so does being prophetic. Let's start by recognizing the cultural disorders or the representative form that the larger cultural disorders take in your own setting within the academy. So I've got five essays that talk about that. And then I've got five really thin books. Not to threaten you too much. I don't want to make you scared. Five really thin books on the disorders of contemporary culture. Then we'll move on to five books that detail some of the textures of 20th century language, art, film, music, and technology. I chose five kind of sectors of specific cultural life to focus on. And then finally, five books by Christian theologians or Christian thinkers that respond to the cultural disorders of modernity and its aftermath. Okay, first, our five essays on academic vocation, the disorders, contemporary university. The first, C.S. Lewis's The Weight of Glory. Many of you know that volume. It contains a sermon that he preached called Learning in Wartime, a sermon which was preached as war was breaking out in Europe. And Lewis, who was a veteran of the First World War, acknowledged the discomfort felt by many at Oxford by the fact that they were enjoying the pleasures and satisfactions of university life while their fellow Britons were being shipped off to the front to suffer and die. But Lewis noted that in that, even in peacetime, every Christian academic faces the same question. How can you devote decades of your life studying 19th century French literature or analytic philosophy or quantum physics when many of your neighbors face eternal damnation? How dare you? And I've actually had email from a young man who heard me speak recently, and he said, how can you talk about culture when people are dying and people are going to hell any minute? How dare you think about that? And that's basically what Lewis is addressing. And his answer is that we don't face the choice between no cultural life and cultural life. That in fact we face the choice between a healthy cultural life and a sick one. There'll always be some cultural experience. Either we'll read good books or we'll read bad books. We won't read no books. We'll have good music or bad music, we won't have no music. We all have a cultural life of some kind. Some ways of ordering our cultural experience are better than others, Lewis had the audacity to assume. And the academic vocation has the potential of encouraging and cultivating the most fruitful and enriching of human experiences. Potential. It doesn't do that doesn't guarantee it doesn't do that as a guarantee. Another gift that scholars can give to the wider community, and this is the main reason I chose this book for this purpose, is the benefit of the possibility of historical perspective. And I'm going to read. I know some people, sometimes it's really annoying when people read from the slides they've created, because I know you can read this. I'm not going to read everything, but in this case I do want to read Lewis's words. "We need intimate knowledge of the past, not that the past has any magic about it, but because we cannot study the future, and yet need something to set against the present." In other words, we're the fish trying to feel, what's it feel like to feel wet? The only way to know it is for fish to get to know squirrels, in a sense. "We need to be reminded that the basic assumptions have been quite different in different periods, and that much which seems certain to the uneducated is merely temporary fashion." Lewis is brilliant on this, for instance, when he talks about the Renaissance and what really happened in the Renaissance. "A man who's lived in many places is not likely to be deceived by the local errors of his native village. The scholar has lived in many times and is therefore in some degree immune," like that, "in some degree, from the great cataract of nonsense that pours from the press and the microphone of his own age." If you've read That Hideous Strength, you know Mark Studdick is commissioned to produce a great cataract of nonsense in the press by the people who run the National Institute of Coordinated Experiments. So scholars can have some complicity in this. They're not immune. But Lewis is expressing here in a relatively mild tone his really dismissive attitude toward a distinctively modern superstition that newer is always better and that we have nothing to learn from the past. I want to underscore this right at the beginning because I think human flourishing requires a proper orientation toward creation. Specifically, it requires an orientation of ourselves well in time and in space. How we encounter, how we contend or deal with time, the realities of time and space, the lived realities of time and space, is a very important issue. One of the things that characterizes modernity, particularly from the time of the Enlightenment, is a dismissal of the past, an assumption that that we have nothing to learn from the past, that tradition is always something to treat with suspicion. I think that's a dehumanizing feature of our cultural setting, and one that's addressed by a number of the sources today. You see this in the academy, where you often run into the notion that the latest scholarship is the best scholarship. The most recent book written about the Civil War is likely to be the most important book written about the Civil War, the best book. Well, in our heart of hearts, most of us know that's not necessarily the case. And yet, the university is often coordinated along what might be called an industrial model, which presupposes that that we need to produce new product regularly, just like a business cycle. Second essay in which this idea of the university run on the industrial model is also addressed is Wendell Berry's essay, The Loss of the University. It challenges very explicitly the tendency to import industrial values into the university, and he begins the essay with a lament that the various disciplines in the university don't speak to each other. That's in the first paragraph. People from different disciplines never talk to each other. People from, you could put a footnote, even within sub-disciplines they never talk to each other. And he admits that while some specialization is necessary in any kind of work, after all, master craftsmen need specialized skills, even if some specialization is necessary, it's proper to assume that there is a degree of specialization that is improper. The impropriety begins, I think, when the various kinds of workers come to be divided and cease to speak to one another. In this division, they become makers of parts of things. Makers of parts of things. What's he have in view there? What's being made in the university? The thing being made in a university is humanity. Underlying the idea of a university, the bringing together, the combining into one of all the disciplines, is the idea that good work and good citizenship are the inevitable byproducts of the good, of the making of a good, that is, a fully developed human being. Human flourishing requires this sense that there is a human purpose. Now, there is an ideal of human flourishing that could be advanced by the university, but because contemporary universities are often unable to talk about human purpose in an unambiguous way, there's no agreement substantively on what human flourishing would look like. Each individual should be equipped to pursue his or her personal vision of flourishing. That's essentially what liberal society suggests. And so the university comes to resemble a factory more than an organism, or specifically a body. I struggle to try to figure out what of Barry's writings to represent here, because I think there's so much that he addresses. I mean, in a sense, human flourishing is the main topic he's concerned about, particularly in how communities are structured and how they're related to places. But he's also brilliant at demonstrating how certain metaphors shape our thinking and acting, and why human flourishing requires using good metaphors, the appropriate metaphors. He says universities are organized on an industrial principle as if faculties and students and all that they might teach and learn are no more than parts of a machine, the purpose of which they have in general not bothered to define, much less to question. And largely through the agency of the universities, this principle and this metaphor now dominate our relation to nature and to one another. Third essay from Robert Jensen, Lutheran theologian. I actually got to interview when this book came out, and I went back and reread it recently. I was giving some lectures on higher education, and the essay here is very rich. It's hard to summarize. The essay called On the Renewing of the Mind, this book is still in print from Erdmann's. His basic argument concerns the paradoxical outcome of the Enlightenment's exaltation of reason. And here he summarizes Nietzsche's diagnosis that the outcome of philosophy, of the West's multi-millennial effort to be reasonable at all costs, is the discovery that there is no reason to be reasonable, and indeed that there's no reason to be anything else that we are not already. And then he goes on, it's the insight of the whole line from Rousseau to Nietzsche that reason undoes itself because it undoes God, without whom reason, as every other interesting virtue, is groundless. Now he's concerned about the idea that many Christians have that, well, we want to be a Christian intellectual, as if what it meant to be an intellectual was already well-defined and well-laid-out. We understood the boundaries, and we want to be a Christian one of those. The noun's already been defined by some other guild, and we want to open our chapter to this. And he basically says this is not the case. That may have been the case one time. May have been. It's no longer the case. If we have a calling, it is not to join a predefined intellectual enterprise, but to reinvent one. And, anticipating his critics, there is nothing preposterous about the notion, since we invented the West's intellectual enterprise in the first place. And here he's speaking about what the universities were. And in the essay, he contrasts the different vision of knowledge from classic antiquity and how the rise of the Western university had a distinctively Christian reality because of the fact that the word has ontological status. The arts of the word might together make a universe. That's an insight from the Bible, he says. So the university, he says, was not a community originally based simply to pursue reason in an Enlightenment sense, which after all is a sheer individual capacity. You don't need a community to pursue truth or reason, to exercise reason. The universities were originally founded as places of conversation, places where the word lived, where scholars could talk and argue about the meaning of the word and the significance of the word. We serve a talkative God, Jensen says in that essay, who does not seem to be able to do without books and libraries. So he's basically saying that rather than allowing our confused modern contemporaries to define the nature of our vocation, that we need to think about it in a truly Christian way. On a lighter note, an essay by Mark Edmondson, who teaches English at UVA. I displayed the cover of his book here because I didn't have access to the cover of the magazine in which the essay originally appears. It's called On the Uses of a Liberal Education as Light Entertainment for Bored College Students. It's online. He gave his permission for it to be duplicated online. You can read it at the address listed there. And Edmondson's a very interesting character. He's kind of a latter-day Emerson in some ways. He's deeply frustrated because the sensibilities of being what he calls a cool consumer, which is the sensibility that dominates the lives of his students, have made it really impossible for students to be hot disciples, which is what he wants them to be. University culture, like American culture writ large, is, to put it crudely, ever more devoted to consumption and entertainment, to the using and using up of goods and images. For someone growing up in America now, there are few available alternatives to the cool consumer worldview. He starts off the essay talking about how much he hates Teacher Evaluation Week, because he gets really good evaluations for the wrong reasons. Dr. Edmondson made Emerson seem so entertaining. You know, he wants to change their lives, and they're looking, you know, they're patting his back for you know, putting on a good show. He contrasts that, what he usually sees, with the course evaluation form from a professor of an earlier generation at Columbia who had a two-question course evaluation form. The first question was, which reading or topic in this course did you find least compelling? And secondly, what intellectual or character defect in yourself does this reveal? You can almost hear him sighing with delight at the, you know, at the possibility of handing something like that to his classes. He goes on, my students didn't ask for that view, that cool consumer worldview, much less create it, but they bring a consumer Weltanschauung to school where it exerts a powerful and largely unacknowledged influence. Excellent essay. Again, in looking at how one institution that is dedicated to a certain set of ends has been, in a sense, hijacked by other cultural institutions with a very different set of sensibilities, not necessarily ends. I mean, the culture of entertainment isn't designed to promote a certain worldview. It's designed principally to make money for people. And yet it's interesting on a lot of levels. First of all, in how university culture has again held captive to other cultural forces, but also to see how those forces work at the level that's sub-intellectual or sub-propositional. Last, and this is kind of cheating because Roger Lundin in the essay Postmodern Gnostics, which is a chapter in this book, does not really deal with the academy. It's not strictly speaking about the university, but this is a nice transition into our next list of five, our thin books, because he talks about the Gnostic assumptions that run rampant in contemporary thought. I my ears pricked up when I heard N.T. Wright mention Gnosticism a few times, which is a theme in many of these sources. The title in this essay is a little bit misleading. He's critiquing a Gnosticism that really is embedded in modernity, which is intensified in some forms of postmodernism. He writes, in the Western world since the Enlightenment, the Gnostic impulse has prompted many to dismiss the idea of an order inherent in nature and to spurn that which has been given to men and women in their cultural and intellectual traditions. He makes this distinction. Classic, historic, second century Gnostics, the ones who were condemned as heretics, Marcion and so on, they took the very fact of embodiment or materiality to be a problem. Our contemporaries aren't as struck by materiality being a problem, although some of them are. Some of them want to escape the body and upload their consciousness into a computer somehow. It's not so much embodiment that contemporary Gnostics take to be the source of evil as it is the embeddedness of the self within the limits of nature and the constrictions of society. The self is constrained by being situated, by being in a specific place. The self wants to delight in timeless truths, and here we are living in history. You know, that's not good. So we have to figure out ways to liberate people from the confines, from the boundaries, from the boundedness of history. Like the Gnostics of the early Christian centuries, philosophers of the Enlightenment, poets of Romanticism took offense at the historical particularity of Christian belief. First part of this essay, which I'll give you the web address again if you didn't get that. This is something we got permission from Erdmans to put online in a PDF file. First part of it is looking at tracing out this history through the Enlightenment and Romanticism. And then the second part is looking at three contemporary writers, Alistair MacIntyre, Wendell Berry, and the poet Richard Wilbur, who he sees as confronting that suspicion about the givenness of nature. MacIntyre, Berry, and Wilbur desire to imagine how Western men and women might regain the ability to conceive of the given worlds of nature and moral history as signs of grace rather than as threats to bondage. Again, Human flourishing, I would submit, is dependent on having a proper orientation toward our createdness and our situatedness within creation. And this essay by Lundin is very helpful in introducing us to the ways in which these three thinkers from three different disciplines, well, Barry and Wilbur are both poets, but Barry's essays are also important, how they work against that kind of Gnosticism. Okay, are really thin books. And I'll try to get through these in a hurry. The first is Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis. I put the subtitle on there because a lot of people who know this book forget that it's actually a book on that starts off being about education and curricular decisions. It actually, in my library, which is in my anal retentive manner ordered by Library of Congress system, it shows up under LB, which everyone knows is the education section. And his argument in here, I think in many ways this was Lewis's most prescient and powerful books. Many of you probably read it. His argument that modern efforts to control nature, to make nature do what we want to, leads to an effort to control human nature or to reconfigure human nature so that it accords better with our desires. If you're familiar with the writings of the so-called transhumanists or the extropians or the posthumanists, someone told me once there's a chair in posthumanist studies. I'm not sure what exactly that would entail, since, or the posthumanities, maybe it was. Human nature 2.0, that's a phrase that shows up in the pages of Wired and places like that very often. That we can re-engineer what it means to be human, either with biotechnology or drugs or something. And Lewis's argument is you end up destroying man in the effort to control man. In effort to control human nature, you end up destroying the very idea of the human. And I think it's helpful to remember that one of the basic assumptions behind the modern project is this assumption of control. The assumption that nature is meaningless stuff devoid of moral order, that all meaning is an arbitrary human construction. Lewis addresses this in the first chapter when he talks about how education involves the ordering of the loves. He uses Augustine's phrase. It's the ordering of the affections. Until quite modern times, all teachers, even all men, believe the universe to be such that certain emotional reactions on our part could either be congruous or incongruous to it. Believed, in fact, that objects did not merely receive, but could merit our approval or disapproval, our reverence or our contempt. Not just that, so we look at the world to figure out how to feel about it, but we're trained, there are certain ways to feel about it which are better than other ways. The little human animal will not at first have the right responses. And here I think he's actually paraphrasing something, I think, from Aristotle. It must be trained to feel pleasure, liking, disgust, and hatred at those things which really are pleasant, likable, disgusting, and hateful. This is not in keeping with contemporary pedagogy, my sense is. And then there's a wonderful passage where Lewis, in one long paragraph, looks at the affinities between magic, particularly magic of the High Renaissance, which was an effort to control nature, and modern technology, which is also an effort to control nature. And he says they have a great affinity. There's something which unites magic and applied science while separating both from the wisdom of earlier ages. For the wise men of old, the cardinal problem had been how to conform the soul to reality, and the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. For magic and applied science alike, the problem is how to subdue reality to the wishes of men. It's a wonderful description, really, of the what makes modernity modern. Modernity abandons the idea that the self should be trained in order to fit with the grain of the universe, as it were, and we're going to remake the grain. We're going to subdue reality to fit our desires. Human control, human willing, becomes an ultimate thing. Hence the idea of the sovereign self. Next, another Wendell Berry book, Life is a Miracle, which is in large measure a response to E.O. Wilson's Consilience, in which Wilson talks about the how wonderful reductionism is. Barry's very nervous about reductionism and says that it promotes bad metaphors, which promote bad thinking and acting in other ways. The most radical influence of reductive science has been the virtual universal adoption of the idea that the world, its creatures, and all the parts of its creatures are machines. That is, there is no difference between creature and artifice, birth and manufacture, thought and computation. Once again, Barry demonstrates how human flourishing is undercut because of a failure of imagination, because of the inappropriateness of metaphors or paradigms that shape our thinking and our actions. No difference between creature and artifice. Moral philosopher Oliver O'Donovan makes a similar argument in his book Begotten or Made, in which he writes that our technological mentality makes it hard for us to recognize that some actions or patterns of living are out of sync with the nature of things. There are no unnatural acts because there is no order in nature. So we end up being able to do whatever we want to in the interest of control, of advancing our own sovereignty. Our language, wherever it is used, is now almost invariably conditioned by the assumption that fleshly bodies are machines full of mechanisms, fully compatible with the mechanisms of medicine, industry, and commerce, and that minds are computers fully compatible with electronic technology. And here, with this point about control, we start to edge toward fundamental ideas also about the nature of freedom. Modern ideas of freedom being not the freedom from the slavery or captivity that we have to our desires, but modern ideas of freedom meaning the absence of restraint or limits on our exercise of desire. And I would argue, though, that human flourishing requires ordered living within blessed limits of a world that's created finite and bounded. There's great moral significance in the fact that we're created as creatures who need to eat, a point that Barry makes over and over. That is, we're created as needy, hungry beings. We're created as beings who are needy before the fall. And that reality of our contingency is a source of important insight, and cultural rituals have often recognized that. That's why we have harvest feasts and celebrate Thanksgiving, to recognize our contingency. That is to recognize our limitedness, and if we take Genesis seriously, it's a good thing to be limited. This idea of a mechanism, he says, may have begun as a metaphor, but it's moved beyond that. And here, the kicker, I think, this usage institutionalizes the human wish or the sin of wishing that life might be or might be made to be predictable, that we can control everything. And if we imagine everything as a mechanism rather than an organism, we're more likely to at least think that we can control everything and try to do it. Next thin book, Colin Gunton's Enlightenment and Alienation. Although the subtitle suggests it's a book about the Trinity, it becomes evident late in the book how the book is about the Trinity, but the Trinity is hovering throughout the book. From the beginning, the book reads more like a survey of the history of views of perception and knowledge. How do we perceive and know the world? But Gunton touches on this theme also, as Lewis and Barry does, the theme of the modern denial of an order in nature. The Enlightenment was right to attack credulity and superstition, but in the process it produced a view of the human mind that falsified its relation to the world, especially in suggesting that there could be attained an absolute objectivity and impartiality, a God's eye view, so to speak, of reality. And he suggests that when the world is reduced into something that is devoid of meaning and devoid of mystery, its bare objectivity is met by the self-assertion of the subject. In other words, we're right in asserting our control over all things in a often tyrannical way, because of the fact that the world has no proper resistance to us. In our desire to impose form on the world and our lives, we've lost the capacity to see the form that is there, and in that lies not liberation but alienation, the cutting off from things as they really are. This is a theme that shows up in his later works, in Gunton's later works also. And he wants to affirm the possibility of real knowledge about creation without suggesting that we have this possibility of omniscience over creation. And it's a wonderful phrase. We stand neither godlike over the material world, as the rationalism of the Enlightenment has encouraged us to think, nor at the mercy of something utterly different and incomprehensible, as some forms of existentialist reaction to rationalism may suggest. We can know the world, though not infallibly, nor with an aim at a kind of omniscience, and I would say nor with an aim of the possibility of omnipotence, because we are both part of it and able to transcend it through our personal powers of perception, imagination, and reason. We're created from the dust of the earth and the breath of God. we're part of it and yet transcendent. And finally, here's where the Trinity comes in most fully in his argument. And this is a wonderful argument that resonates nicely with the Colossians 1:15-20 passage that we looked at yesterday morning. A world that owes its origins to a God who makes it with direct reference to one who was become incarnate, part of that world, is a world that is a proper place for human beings to use their senses, minds, and imaginations, and to expect they will not be wholly deceived in doing so. In other words, we can have the confidence of real knowledge about creation, that we can know something about the world. We don't have to have the possibility of comprehensive omniscience in order to believe in the possibility of real knowledge. And the real knowledge is there because the world is ordered with respect to Christ who enters into the world. Another thin book, in at least materially. Doesn't take up much shelf space, but it's thick in other ways. George Parkin Grant's English Speaking Justice. I wanted to get Grant on the list somehow, not just as kind of a Canadian affirmative action here, but also because I think his work is neglected. He's a resource Christians should know better. In several, I won't summarize all of the argument in English Speaking Justice, just point to one theme that shows, again, in terms of understanding cultural history, how unintended consequences work to undo intents of people very often. In several of the works, he's quite critical of the Puritans, and he sensed that the Puritans really were radical predecessors to a secularized modernity. And in his argument, which is difficult to summarize, he includes the idea that by focusing on the will of God, a will that was often described in isolation from God's love, justice, mercy, goodness, and wisdom, the Puritans unwittingly added momentum to the modern tendency to see will as the ultimate human attribute. He writes elsewhere of our nihilistic will to will, and he describes the spirit of American Puritanism as the responsibility which could find no rest. In this essay, he writes, the Puritan interpretation of the Bible produced more a driving will to righteousness than a hunger and thirst for it. As it became secularized in America, that will became the will of self-righteousness and produced its own incarnation in Emerson. American Protestantism today, above all, is pietist. This has given it the strength to continue, even through all the modernizing of rural and small-town America, but this pietism has little intellectual bite compared to the Calvinism it replaced, so that its direct practical effect on the control of technology, which Grant believed was the central political question, is generally minimal. And then finally, one thin book. It's thicker than the others, but still relatively thin. Richard Weaver's Ideas Have Consequences. I included this for two reasons. It influenced my thinking as a younger person starting to work through these ideas. Also, Weaver's an interesting connection to Wendell Berry because of the influence that he was under as a young man, the original Tennessee agrarians at Vanderbilt, and a group of thinkers that Berry has in print acknowledged as in some ways his great-granddaddies. Weaver touches on a number of things. He's better at describing conditions than diagnosing how the conditions evolve. He wrote in a foreword to a later edition of the book that he felt that the book was an intuition of a situation, a world that had lost its center, which desires to believe again in value and obligation, but this world is not willing to realize how it has lost its belief or to face what it must accept in order to regain faith in an order of goods. And by an order of goods, I think he's suggesting that some things we value, and rightly so, require commitment to other things. Often other things we don't like as much. That's true in the health of communities as well as the health of individuals. We don't like training our desires, and yet it turns out that living well in community does require the training of desires. Another theme that shows up here, and this book is eminently underlinable. I find he didn't write it to be aphoristic, but almost every page has something in it that's worthy of citation. And here he gets into an interesting question about time. The decision of modern man to live in the here and now is reflected in the neglect of aging parents, whom proper sentiment once kept in positions of honor and authority. There was a time when the elder generation was cherished because it represented the past. Now it is avoided and thrust out of sight for the same reason. This is in 1948, by the way. As man becomes more immersed in time and material gratifications, belief in the continuum of the race fades, and not all the tinkering of sociologists can put homes together again. This attitude toward time, represented by our lack of honor accorded to our elders. At this conference, we've heard a couple of references to the disorders of racial and class segregation as obstacles to human flourishing, but age segregation, I would suggest, is at least as serious a problem, and one that's rarely addressed in Christian circles, although it's addressed quite explicitly in Scripture in many ways. The unity of generations is repeatedly cited in Scripture as an emblem of blessedness or human flourishing. Psalm 120, that's what the whole psalm is about. The very last verse in the Old Testament speaks of a prophet who will come and turn the hearts of the parents to their children and the children to their parents. And then, of course, the fifth commandment, the commandment which has a promise about it, and that of human flourishing. If you honor your father and your mother, you will live long in the land that I give to you, God says. Now, he's not saying you'll have a longer average life expectancy. That's how we tend to read those things. We tend to read those things. We read so many texts that are addressed to communities as if they're addressed to us as individuals. The nation of Israel will thrive if intergenerational continuity is part of its life. That's one of the Ten Commandments. Now, the segregation of generations is, the radical segregation of generations is an invention of mid-20th century commercial culture. Through what we call youth culture. Its roots, in some ways, are deep in the Enlightenment, although I'm not sure that Elvis Presley had that in mind. In Kant's famous essay on Enlightenment, he talks about how we're mature now, we don't need our ancestors. But it's remarkable to me the extent to which churches and parachurch groups quickly adapted to the idea of youth culture, which was a new thing in human history. It shows up in the late 1940s and is itself the result of a number of the confluence of a number of technical and economic forces. But I think that we've actively advanced the cause of segregation of generations in many ways. And I think that that's a way that we've adopted the disordered way of life of our age in the interest of reaching more people with the message about an ethereal, eternal life. But I would go so far as to say I think the biggest single project that could serve human flourishing that we could commit ourselves to is a recovery of an ideal of intergenerational unity. It's not just parents and children, but again, a strong sense of who our ancestors and descendants are. Weaver talks about this, and this is a theme that shows up in Lewis also, the idea of provincialism in time, a tendency to be suspicious toward the past. He says that this is a kind of psychopathic phenomenon because it involves impairment of memory, which is known to be one of the commonest accompaniments of mental pathology. It is apparent, moreover, that those who are in rebellion against memory are the ones who wish to live without knowledge, and we can, in fact, tell from their conduct that they act more than others on instinct and sensation. This idea of memory, Barry shows up regularly in Barry's work. His essay, The Work of Local Culture, which is in the anthology What Are People For? He talks about the very notion of community is a group of people rooted in place and rooted in place over time. Again, we tend to think of community as something we experience on a weekend, on a retreat, and not something that's rooted in place over time. Okay, we need to move on. Okay, the books are getting thicker. But they may be more fun because there are movies involved. And we'll start with a book that wins the award for the most fun subtitle, Doing Our Own Thing, The Degradation of Language and Music and Why We Should Like Care, by John McWhorter, a linguist who taught at UC Berkeley. McWhorter's book, his basic argument is that American linguistic usage has radically changed in the past 40 years, abandoning, for all intents and purposes, abandoning a formal register of speech. He has a number of anecdotes about how different cultures, from the most primitive of cultures, have multiple registers or styles of speech, which are used depending on the occasion. I was talking to someone who was a missionary in Nepal for a number of years. He said, "Oh yeah, there's some forms you only use when, like, the emperor is present or something. I don't know if they have an emperor. Some great potentate is present. Then you use a certain linguistic form." But all cultures have this tendency of multiple registers of speech, and particularly serious occasions that have a kind of gravity about them, call for the most formal of speech. And so the grammatical and syntactical patterns in a bowling alley are different from those of a presidential funeral. Now, in cultures with written languages, texts tend to be more formal, and formal speech aspires, McWhorter says, to the condition of writing. But this started to change in America in the mid-1960s, he argues. Instances of formal speech patterns in American culture have dwindled significantly. He shows, for instance, speeches made after the bombing of Pearl Harbor with speeches made after 9/11 in Congress by people with about the same educational capacity. Remarkably different. He suggests that if Lincoln had ended the Gettysburg Address with "Let's roll," as our president did one of his speeches, he may have been assassinated years earlier. Now, this is a fun book, okay? It's a fun book, but it has a very serious point. The American typically relates warmly to the use of English to the extent that it summons the oral, while passing from indifference to discomfort to the extent that its use leans toward the stringent artifice of written language. And he says that he argues that the best he can tell as a linguist, linguists who do historical research try to figure out, why does the language change? What caused this radical linguistic usage change? Was it because of new immigration patterns or television? What was it? And he suggests that it was different attitudes toward authority. He argues that informality became generic in America, the mainstream of the counterculture. Linguistically, every day would become casual day. Formality in all realms, be it sartorial, terpsichorean, culinary, artistic, or linguistic, entails the dutiful acknowledgement of higher public standards considered beyond question, requiring tutelage and effort to master with embarrassing slippage and eternal threat. That's not comfortable for people who are suspicious of authority. And he argues that that this has very negative consequences. It compromises our facility with the word, dilutes our collective intellect, our new sense of what American English is, has upended our relationship to articulateness, our approach to writing, and how or whether we impart it to the young, our interest in poetry. He has a lot in here on poetry and the role it has in both social life and personal life, and our conception of what it is, and even our response to music and how we judge it. He's a big fan of Broadway musicals, and one of his chapters discusses the change from Cole Porter to some of the more contemporary musicals. And again, the use of language, but also the use of musical structure. How did this happen? Here's another slide on what is lost. Whatever it gains from the warm viscerality of unadorned talk, a society that cherishes the spoken over the written is one that marginalizes extended reflective argument. Spoken language is best suited to harboring easily processable chunks of information, broad lines, and emotion. To the extent that our public discourse leans ever more toward this pole, the implications for the prospect of an informed citizenry are dire. And he has a lot of details about newspaper writing, journalistic writing, that's reporting on significant matters of public import that aspires to kind of a casual... I mean, you just see this on the TV morning news shows, and the kind of casual attitude. It's all chatty and, you know, jokey. Everything's jokey, till you have to report on a bunch of people dying, and then they really struggle to find the right face to wear while they talk about that. How did this happen? Again, authenticity has always been an important value in American history, along with individualism. But he argues that the 1960s focused this to an unprecedented degree. In response to thinking people's recasting of the American establishment as a mistake in need of correcting, unworthy of personal allegiance, The result was a new cultural norm, elevating the natural to an extreme that would have shocked 19th century transcendentalists and romantics. I love the line, Thoreau would have been baffled by Woodstock. Sparked in a subset, and here he means hippies, I guess, especially concerned with socio-political issues, this cult of the informal easily spread in waves throughout the less tuned-in realms of the culture. It was carried partly on its charisma, partly on its sheer comfort. The principle of least effort entices us all, and few revolutions have asked less of their adherents than the one that called for us to shed starchy formalities, scoff at authority, and have more sex. Thus, what began as rebellion mellowed into reflex indignation among a committed minority, conventionalized into fashion among a game majority. Wonderful description of cultural change. Cultural change that starts with a political cause that ends up having, again, unintended, in some ways unanticipatable consequences in a larger cultural setting. And we won't talk about what it does to worship. Use and abuse of art, Jacques Barzan. Again, I wanted to have something that charted changes in the art world in the late 19th and early 20th centuries as art becomes fully modern, which I think it's helpful in understanding modernity. And it was a toss-up between this book and Robert Hughes's book, Shock of the New, which is bigger and more expensive, but it has lots of pretty pictures. These are the texts for six lectures that Barzan gave. And Barzan also has the advantage of being a cultural generalist. He describes quite well in here, explicitly describes how art displaced religion as a source of moral order and personal fulfillment. The deism and atheism of the 18th century, its skepticism of materialism, left many earnest souls seeking an outlet for piety. In answer to this need, Rousseau pointed to the spectacle of nature. And as he points out, with that revelation, Rousseau opened the way to artists and thinkers called Romanticists, who undertook the task of reconstruction after skepticism. They did not abandon reason, but demanded its complement. It turned out to be the religion of art. He also makes this interesting observation in one of the lectures, the idea that religious feeling was a separate part of human psychology. A faculty might find its proper object here or there. Religion had formerly been but an aspect of a total belief that merged together the history of the world, physics, ancient customs, and the established political state. Interesting, again, kind of an aside in the context, but suggesting how religion was personalized as well as privatized in the 19th century. Okay, moving on. David Thompson, The Whole Equation. My undergraduate degree was in film studies, so I tend to be fussy about recommending books on film. And Thompson is a critic who I like to read, and I often smile at reading him, even when I disagree with him. And this book is not so much a history of American movies as it is a history of the making of movies, and the making of movies in a very specific place, Hollywood, California. A place with a specific history, with a specific role in American consciousness, a particular kind of light. He starts off with a discussion of the film Chinatown, which is set in L.A., and set in a particular time in L.A.'s history. And he nicely correlates the history of California, the history of America. He's very perceptive in teasing out social effects of movies, which are not just a new mode of expression, but they're a new social activity. He also muses on the effects of our inner lives on the experience of movies, not just the content of their scripts. And here he's talking here about the very earliest experience of watching stories unfold on screen in public, and how this was a new kind of experience. Our culture had reached an extraordinary new kind of predicament and privilege, that of watching heightened things, great danger, great desirability, intense loveliness, without being tied by the responsibilities that attach to real onlookers. Really interesting and he does tease out, what does this do to our sense of public belonging, our sense of membership in the public, when so much of what we see as detached observers on a screen. Also, he talks about how acting and the prominence of acting and of actors. Oops, did I just lose something? Yes. Has affected us. Very interesting speculation. In 100 years or so of marketed movie entertainment and its frequent flirtations with business glory and even artistic distinction, is it possible that the most profound thing that has been going on is the way in which so many of us have been led to think less of reality and more of a dream, and the manner in which acting has carried us over the hump. Suppose the whole thing has been designed to make us politely disordered or more elastic. It is as if in the 20th century, the professional craft of pretending had brushed up against our old sense of identity just as it became destabilized by the slippage of religious belief. We're not sure who we are anymore, because we're not sure what the world is anymore. At this very same time, suddenly this new experience of watching people who perform their lives in a way that's larger than life for us, there's a mixture of thrill and dread in the contact. The possibility of play, of acting, reaches out toward the uncertainty in which we are losing trust with so many of the principles of behavior or being we've been asked to adhere to. It's been a lot of writing in the last 10 years or so about the culture of celebrity that plays on this idea that we all have a sense that we're performing our lives. We don't have real life. We're all just constantly living the life of an avatar or some adopted persona. And so the reason why performers are so important part of our public life is because they're the ones who do it best. We're all performing, but they're the ones who get paid for it and do it best. And they're more attractive than we are. Look at actors closely and wonder if they're not pioneering some perilous process for us. Another effect. I think we've become more promiscuous. This is where he's talking about, again, the perception of acting. Less steadfast in our behavior. I dare say we're more in love now with the idea of love than with the reality. Put it another way, we've become a little more like actors waiting for a fresh part, a new start. Now, again, here there's a wonderful speculation in here about, again, cultural consequences. As Andy Crouch says, I get nervous with people who talk about culture principally in terms of a history of ideas. So here he's suggesting that the divorce rate, and he addressed that specifically in this setting, the divorce rate may have less to do with what people think about marriage than in kind of a kind of intuition that they have because of the fact that they're so used to watching acting. Another thing I just want to mention, move on to the next one. I find in the reading I do that non-Christian critics on a variety of cultural issues, particularly on film and literature, seem to be capable of making more courageous judgments about cultural phenomena than Christians. I think Christians tend to very often, well, unless they're really uninformed, they very often kind of pull their punches. They're not as eager to make a strong statement about something. I think because they're worried about apologetic winsomeness. They're worried that some non-believer might take offense at something they've said. And so they're not willing to be as critical of things as they might be. Except, again, there are a lot of uninformed people who are more than willing to be very critical. Here again, what propels film narrative, talking about how film works, and he has a whole section on the close-up and Nicole Kidman's face. I think he wrote a book about Nicole Kidman's face, actually, a whole separate book. She's there on the cover. If the face is eager or hooked enough, we want to see what it sees, and thus the gradual disclosure of things becomes the narrative line of a film. If books are about the possibility or potential of meaning, films are about disclosure, revelation, appearance, the world of visibility, and the fetishization of appearance. It is a medium most acute when it's fixed on what happens next, whereas literature, sooner or later, is about the meaning behind events. This is, again, a lot of film theorists have said similar things. And those kinds of observations are often not attended to, if I can editorialize a little more intensely here, by a lot of Christians who say, well, we're moving into a visual age, we just have to adapt to it. Well, how do images work differently from what books do? Julian Johnson, who needs classical music? He's interested in how music works, as Jeremy Begbie is. Elvis Costello once famously said, talking about music is like dancing about architecture. And he was partly right. There is something finally ineffable about what music does in our lives and how it works. And yet, the same could be said about love, food, God, and many other transcendent subjects, and we talk about those. Again, Johnson's intrigued with a question about the precipitate decline in interest in classical music among educated Westerners in the past 50 years. I can remember Leonard Bernstein's Young Persons concerts being broadcast network television in prime time with the New York Philharmonic. That doesn't happen. Beverly Sills, Johnny Carson went on vacation one week and Beverly Sills hosted for him. It's hard to imagine an operatic soprano in that kind of public role today. And he's very intrigued with what kinds of things have transpired in the broader culture. When I wrote my book All God's Children in Blue Suede Shoes, I wanted to call it Immediately Yours, because I thought that one of the characteristics of popular culture was its promise of immediacy, which has a kind of Gnostic character to it. Classical music, like all art, has always been based on a paradoxical claim, that it relates to the immediacy of everyday life, but not immediately. It addresses emotions, it addresses experiences, but it takes time to understand the vocabulary and the way it communicates. It takes aspects of our immediate experience and reworks them, reflecting back in altered form. In this way, it creates for itself a distance from the everyday while preserving a relation to it. Here he talks again about the problem, and this echoes some things that Lewis says in Abolition of Man, the idea that musical judgment is purely personal. He says taste historically has not been terribly important. I'm going to rush on here. To an earlier age, our contemporary idea of a complete relativism of musical judgment would have seemed nonsensical. One could no more make valid individual judgments about music than about science. Music was no more a matter of taste than was the orbit of the planets. And yet that... this question of whether there's an order that... that will shape our shared life, an order in the nature of things that is perceivable and describable, and whether our affections need to be trained to recognize that order. Here's another interesting point, and this relates to the problem of Gnosticism. Some people say, well, classical music, because people don't dance at symphony concerts, it's very Gnostic. Well, actually, there's a lot of bodily stuff going on, and a lot of stuff going on in time, as well as with sound, which are all part of the material world. But also, he suggests that music, well-constructed, carefully constructed music that takes time to develop. He suggests that it has this peculiar insistence on the tension between the bodily and the intellectual, the material and the spiritual. Much of contemporary culture appears to be in complete denial of this tension. I suggest, therefore, that classical music is a form of cultural resistance. It opposes a process by which we reduce the world to opaque, depthless objects, here echoes of Wendell Berry, and with it ourselves. It becomes marginal precisely where it does not easily collude in this process. And last, in this series, something on technology, Langdon Winner. This is really hard, because this was one of the hardest slots to fill, because it's hard to think of a book that I do a lot of reading on technology and culture. I chose this one in part because of the way he integrates political and social concerns with technological history, but also because the theme of this book is he's actually looking at not the history of a technology, but the history of an idea about technology. The people worrying about the technology is going to run. It's going to start running our lives. It's going to be out of control. You know, all those science fiction movies where the computers take over the world, you know, Battlestar Galactica, Terminator, you know, technology starts to run things. That's a long-standing fear, early on. And he writes early in the book, the conclusion that something is out of control is interesting only insofar as we expect that it ought to be in control in the first place. Not all cultures share our insistence that the ability to control things is a necessary prerequisite of human survival. Western culture, however, has long believed that its continued existence and advancement depend upon the ability to manipulate the circumstances of the material world. In a spirit that may have been called Faustian, we believe that control is possible and that we must strive for it. Question, and then I'm going to run through the quotes for Winner. Is human flourishing served by our assumption of the possibility of control, or is it deterred? That is something you can discuss on your essay question for the test. Okay, we're going to move past this. On to the next category, Christian responses, and we'll try to get through this so we can have a little bit of time for questions. Leslie Newbegin, again, there were three or four books by him that I wasn't sure what was best to include. this is one where he's most explicit about this theme that I've been focusing on, how we know the world, how we orient ourselves in the world, and the modern assumption that detaches us, alienates us, in Colin Gunton's phrase. And here he talking particularly about Descartes and the dualism that is really reinforced by Descartes. So long as this dualism remains part of popular thought, it is impossible for the gospel to be accepted as public truth. It can only be private opinion. And I would suggest that that dualism is profound in still very profound in the church. Second book, Democratization of American Christianity. I apologize for the quality of that graphic, but the cover has been lost to my copy, and I couldn't scan it, and none of the bookstores had decent graphics online. Fascinating book looking at how populism and a commitment to the sovereignty of the self was really adopted by the early American evangelicals, early 19th century conservative Christians, who found that that they could identify very strongly with these themes of that showed themes which were prominent, particularly in the Jacksonian period, of suspicion toward elites. Here, a diverse array of American evangelical firebrands went about the task of movement building in the generation after the Revolution, intent on bringing evangelical conversion to the mass of ordinary Americans. They could rarely divorce that message from the contagious new democratic vocabularies and impulses that swept through American popular cultures. There was widespread disdain for the supposed lessons of history and tradition and a call for reform using the rhetoric of the Revolution. This shift involved new faith in public opinion as an arbiter of truth. These new ground rules measured theology by its acceptance in the marketplace. It flattened out uncomfortable complexity and often resolved issues by simple choice of alternatives. Similar narrative, we're going to have to move on. Similar narrative in James Turner's Without God, Without Creed. He's basically trying to say, answer the question in this book, how did you go from a time when atheism seemed palpably absurd to, within less than a generation, a time when atheism emerged as an option fully available within the general contours of Western culture? And he basically argues that theologians did this. The church did this. The church did this because in trying to adapt religious beliefs to socioeconomic change, to new moral challenges, to novel problems of knowledge, the defenders of God slowly strangled him. The church played a major role in softening up belief. Theologians had been too unwilling to allow God to be incomprehensible, too insistent on bringing him within the compass of mundane human knowledge, too anxious to link belief with science, too neglectful of other roads of knowledge, too insensitive to non-cognitive ways of apprehending reality, too forgetful, in short, of much of their own traditions as they tried to make God up to date, too modern, one could say, in summary. And that effectively made God an unnecessary hypothesis. Craig Gaze, The Way of the Modern World, Why It's Tempting to Live as If God Doesn't Exist, in which Gay, who's a sociologist who studied with Peter Berger, makes the argument that many of the structures of modern life make us into practical atheists, or perhaps more accurately might be practical deists. Contemporary society and culture so emphasize human potential and human agencies and the immediate practical exigencies of the here and now that we are for the most part tempted to go about our daily lives in this world without giving God much thought. One of the most insidious temptations fostered within contemporary secular society and culture, not by its ideas, not by what's taught, not by the tracts written by German philosophers or French film critics, but by the shape of everyday life, is the temptation to practical atheism. This is a wonderful book. I've used it in a variety of study groups with interns. And let's see. We're going to jump through here. Finally, last one. Colin Gunton, again, One, the Three, and the Many, where he picks up on this idea of alienation that he'd addressed earlier in his career. How we belong in the world, how we inhabit the world. Until modern times, and indeed during some of its phases, social order was nearly always understood to be rooted in some way in an insight into what we can call metaphysical order, the order of being as a whole, the order of nature. It is this that Descartes and his successors have destroyed, and with it the symbiosis of social and universal order. In general, it was held in the ancient world that knowledge of the universe contained the key to human society. In this respect, the Old Testament is no different from other contemporary religious writings. Especially you see this in the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, where the order evident in creation is somehow emblematic of or metaphorical, analogical to moral order. By contrast, it is generally held in the modern world there's no link between cosmic and social order. One could define modernity as an era in which the human race has achieved, or attempted to achieve, an autonomy from the environment, which consists in freedom from any form of natural determination. Again, we want to remake reality to fit our desires. That is part of the meaning of disengagement. One of the marks of some modern secular thought is a deep pessimism deriving from the belief that the universe is an empty and hostile place, whose scientifically perceived meaning is seen as an irrelevance to human living. Yesterday in Dr. Wright's talk, he talked about the end of this confidence that modernity has wrought, and yet most postmodern thinkers don't seem to have a viable alternative to it. And I think that, again, there have been a lot of writings in the last 10 years or so by Christians on postmodernity and the church's response to postmodernity. I think that reflection would be assisted by more reflection on the modernity that preceded it. What was that project all about that we now think failed? And then we have a better sense of how that project is really in significant ways still continuing. It hasn't been abandoned. Our desire for control and our sense that there is no natural order in the nature of things is still very, very strong. So that was a whirlwind, but you have about 5 years to do the readings. Is that when the next meeting is? So enjoy. Questions? Yeah.
This is a rather offbeat one, but I want to pick your brains because you think about culture. I'm a pediatrician, or a retired pediatrician. 100 years ago, we never diagnosed premature puberty in girls until the age of 16. Now we don't diagnose it when they reach the age of 8. Clearly, girls have lost their childhood to a considerable degree. Do you have any cultural comments on this?
I probably could eventually, or at least a footnote to it. Just out of curiosity, is it assumed that that's an environmental change? Is this like plastics, chemicals?
That we in the sort of technical professions are only concerned with practical outcomes.
Right.
There's virtually no discussion about it, but I suspect it's due to the pill.
Yeah.
And it's due to the fact that our water is now contaminated with all contraceptives.
Right.
In fact, the pill would, if you wanted a technological device that has destroyed us,
I'd have to think about it. It's intriguing, particularly because of the fact that the culture in which those 8-year-olds live doesn't have a trajectory, doesn't have a script for achieving adulthood and for the possibility and meaning of maternity. So it's ironic in a way, and a kind of cruel irony that there's no framework of understanding what that entails. That 8-year-old is less likely to have a sense of what it means than she would have been 100 years ago. It has some interesting resonances with P.D. James's book, The Children of Men.
Yes.
in which you have a culture that becomes barren entirely. And she suggests that it takes this kind of drastic situation for the culture to start thinking about life and the generation of life. But I'll think more about it.
Well, I had one extra point to go with that you just raised. Is at one point I was somewhat deeply involved with the Rwandan war and was in Africa for a while. And it was fascinating to me that the one drug that didn't move in the refugee camps was antidepressants.
Ah.
And the drug that arrived from America in missionary packs from Christians who were getting rid of what they didn't need was antidepressants.
Yeah. I gather that the CIA is now distributing Viagra to Afghan warlords to help our war on terror, which there's all kinds of interesting possibilities, reflection there, yes.
You know, you've given us some great suggestions for books and essays. Is there a book or an essay that you wish would be written that you have not seen?
Well, I tell you, one of them would be, I would love to see, if there are any history graduate students looking for in American cultural history, looking for a subject, I'd be real interested in, there have been some really interesting books on the rise of the idea of youth culture. And its material causes, post-war prosperity, television, universal high school education, a bunch of interesting confluence of things. I would love to see someone write about the way religious communities reacted to the idea that that young people would now be tutored, discipled by their peers or by advertisers, rather than by their parents and their elders, in terms of an order in things, wasn't that perceived as being an odd way to raise children, or an odd way to arrive at maturity, an odd way to anticipate and be nurtured into adulthood? Well, now we're after three generations of this. We now no longer see adulthood as an ideal of some sort to be achieved, which has civic as well as ecclesiastical and familial obligations attached to it. So, you know, the ideal is now of the perpetual adolescent. There has been stuff written about that, but this intervening period, how is it that particularly religious leaders adapted so quickly? I mean, the word teenager I don't think was ever even used until 1948. It's relatively late. But, you know, Youth for Christ is up and running by like 1949 or so. You know. So, okay, oh, teenagers, let's have a ministry to them. Without asking, what about the social ecosystem, social and cultural ecosystem that, you know, this is a radical change, unprecedented. So that's a book that I'd like to see. Yes?
Is there a lot out on digital art and new media, because I feel like this media is heavily exploited by industry for like commercial gains, and I feel like technology has a way of being all things to all people if the people were able to use it, but since we're at a lack of technological literacy, it's only used by people who have the financial or resources to use it.
I'm trying to think. Somebody recently commented, I read an essay recently on how the internet, once assumed to be a decentralizing and populizing medium, actually has concentrated a lot of power. It's just concentrated differently, but actually, you know, Google is going to like run everybody's lives. Well, let me ask a different question. Because you pit two things in antithesis: individuals doing creative work and corporate/commercial powers, kind of exploiting the possibility. See, one of the things that we rarely even think about is what about the communal role that this has? In other words, do we think of art simply as either a mode of personal expression, which may have an audience, we want an audience for it, on the one hand, or something which is a tool of some kind of potential exploitation on the other. But can we think of it in a middle way as something that is a resource of communities? I've been thinking a lot lately about the cultures historically have always been tacitly understood. And cultures and the artifacts within them, artwork or music or whatever, have always historically been understood as a kind of legacy or inheritance, something that is passed on, part of a way of life that's passed on from one generation to the next. Because of technical, political, philosophical, economic changes in the 19th and 20th century, we now tend to think of culture as a set of commodities individually chosen. So cultural artifacts, like the digital art or digital media you suggest, they don't. It's hard for us to even imagine how they might be part of an inheritance, part of a way of life that we pass on to our children. And my sense is, rather than looking at these specific things and how they can be used in good ways, the part of the task is to figure out how can we recover a sense. I'm convinced that human flourishing requires a sense of belonging, requires a sense of being part of a people in some way that we're attached to over time. It's remarkable to me that Hebrews 12, a letter that's written to people who are considering apostasy, it crescendos with this long historical trajectory of all these, this procession of saints and faithful people that precedes us. So all the arguments about the superiority of Christ to the Levitical order and all those other complicated things going on in the first part of the book, when it comes down to it, you're part of a people. You're just the most recent chapter in that. So I think that's you know, think about practices that sustain the consciousness of members of churches, that their most important sense of, that their sense of identity really is in the body, that they don't know who they are apart from that membership in the body. And that's what it means to be a culture, that's what it means to be part of a community. And I would say that human flourishing requires it. We're not created to flourish individually. We're created to flourish as members of one another. So we have 1 minute. Any other questions?
Will your second session be repeated?
It's just a repeat of this.
Okay.
Yes.
I just make an observation, but maybe it's a question, but the photogenic order about the degradation of language is something we come into contact all the time.
Yeah.
Students in now with the critical mass of texting.
Oh, yeah.
One can only wonder that we get these kind of crazy emails
that
say, hey, I won't be in class.
Right, emails. I talked to some professors at a West Coast university who said that they get emoticons in term papers.
Yeah.
And text messaging abbreviations, you know, LOL, in the middle of a term paper? No. And they have a hard time explaining why this really, there's something wrong with this.
See, it reminds me of the comment in Slaughterhouse-5 where Vonnegut says, protesting against warfare is like protesting against glaciers.
Yeah.
And I wonder if we're just being old fogies,
well,
or if there's anything we can actually do.
Well, I was heartened again by Wright's comments about poetry yesterday. That language and the capacity for poetry are a deep part of human flourishing. And poetry is, again, a communal thing that's shared. And so part of the problem with this language is not that, oh, it's a new thing, we don't like new things, but is it a new thing that eclipses the capacity to understand the old things, that eliminates the possibility of actually entering into the imagination of our ancestors? If writing that way makes it harder to read Jane Austen and to enter into a kind of common humanity with her, then that's what makes it bad. Not that it's inarticulate or snarky or whatever problems it has. It's that it obscures us from, again, a sense of cultural inheritance. Okay, got to run. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Is it available online?
No.
We have been
assigned.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Yeah, great.
PDF,
but whatever's easy for you.
Yeah, okay.
There's a whole chapter on Eliel, and I didn't mention it. I said half time in the language.
Okay.
Winter's a little more accessible.
Okay. All right. I'm sure you had your reason.
But he has a whole chapter on Eliel, and it's actually some very helpful stuff.
Yeah. Of course, that's who I chose to come from. Right. That's who I grew up.
Yeah.
You know, I kept my teeth.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Lost, but if there are others, he's going to do a better job.
I'll tell you what, I think he's coming more and more. I interviewed a guy named Richard Seiber, who's a sociologist, who writes on technology and culture. He's profoundly influenced by it. In fact, he's basically trying to continue with this project. Richard Stivers,
I don't know that name.
He's got a couple, I've interviewed him once or twice.
Yeah, I can do it.
Very provocative. But Eliel was a little quirky.
Well, yeah. But you know, the other book you mentioned, Propaganda, Violence.
Oh,
you remember that?
Yeah.
In terms of the incredible naivete of that, right, left, listening ears. Eliel was miles
ahead.
You know, on that. Anybody I see who's
right.
I mean, yes, you might be able to see them if you want a starting place. Let's go there.
Yeah. Is that a current story?
You know, I don't know. I have my cousins. Yeah, I think it is. I think that's right. Yeah. So good. Well, I very much appreciate it. It's a great update since my day.
Yeah,
I'm able to keep up with everything. So great. And I've got my syllabus for the.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
So, And he rhymes with panache and venom.
Panache and venom.
That's what I like.
He just makes me incoherent. He said, what?
We're actually going to leave you. Sorry.
Okay.
Just so not
okay. Because I tell you what, I'll get my stuff. Someone
you get this, I'll make sure that's okay.
David Stowe, like Booker, you know. Darwinian fairy tales, published by you'll enjoy him immensely. He's written others that are a little more obscure, like Cricket and Republicans and Plato as well.
Yeah. Sorry I didn't have much on bioethics. A lot of
it. Well, isn't it amazing that
I did have Essence of Man, which is important.
Life is a miracle.
And I don't know how much family. I don't know how much.
Not a lot.
Yeah. Because that's
And the choice of speakers has been, to some degree, at least determined by the gender rather than by the content. Quite clearly.
Well, anyway, maybe I'll see you later.
Yeah. So, I'm good to meet you.
Yes. I have to write a book before you. But, I mean, there are about 140 pages out there.
Oh, I know. Well, actually, your name has been on a list of a friend of mine named Mike Poor, who's in Nashville.
Yeah.
Does a humanitized one.
Yeah.
He's the first one I've introduced.
Yeah. You know about the college you run, Augustine?
Yeah. In fact,
you must have had David Jeffrey.
When you first didn't
David Jeffrey.
David Lyle Jeffrey.
Have you had him?
No, I haven't interviewed him yet.
You've got to.
I know. I had lunch with him and Ralph Wood once. He's got to be. Oh, I know.
The top evangelical intellect on the continent.
I did a piece about him.
Yeah.
When he lost his job.
Yeah. Because when he went to Princeton, he had to choose between physics and medieval English.
Okay.
And he rode rodeo in the summer.
Yeah. Listen, I've got to move my computer. Yeah, sure.
Good to hear you.
I was just
going
to ask if I could get the
slide.
Sure.
Yeah, I'll just
sit
as a PDF. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
That's interesting.
Thanks for
your presentation.
Okay. You want to put your email address on there, too?
Yeah, I appreciate it.
It's only the second time I've used
it. It's great presentation.
So I hope it was helpful.
I just want to say thanks to your work.
Oh, thank you.
I've been piggybacking off of my dad's
screen
for a number of years now, but I've learned a ton just
listening
to the audio journal.
Well, that's why we're there.
Great.
Oh, good. Where do you
learn a lot from TouchNotes? Yeah. So.
Now, I think I recognize your name, so I must have seen your dad's name on our list, maybe.
Really?
Thank you so much.
Is that possible?
Yeah, no. He's my dad is Fernando Gouveia.
Okay. Yeah. I think,
just keep in touch.
Oh, yeah,
to talk about. I know you're busy, so.
Well, good to see you.
I want to publish that.
Okay, well, I haven't even looked at it in a long time.
Yeah, so.
Oh, you got the other end of that.
I got the other end.
We can talk about that.
Okay.
Series. Perfect. You got all the work going. You're on a roll with all this.
I hope so.
I don't know much about anything. I'm just
going to
grab
the
wires.
Okay.
If you
want to
help it.
Sure. Yeah, now also, underneath the table is the case that the machine came in.
Oh, okay.
If you could grab that as well, because I need to get that back.
Okay. I'm not going to come and get that unless I need another one, but I think I'm okay.
Is it right that you know Ben Kahn?
Do you need me to carry any of your food?
I think I can get it all. Thanks very much.
Okay.
Yeah, Ben was an intern of mine one summer.
I was going to sit here till make sure. Maybe I'll go over there to make sure people are coming. That you'll be there.
How do you know Ben?
I was at Cambridge for the last 3 years.
Okay.
So he's been doing his PhD there.
The year after his freshman year. He spent a summer as an intern with me.
Yeah.
And I saw him sometime after he got married, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't seen him in a while. Give him my greetings.
I will. Thanks.
What are you doing at Cambridge?
Well, I was at Cambridge. I was doing I did a second BA and an MPhil in classics.
Uh-huh.
And now I'm actually at Chicago.
Okay.
Starting a PhD there.
Okay, good. In classics or?
In classics. That's
okay.
Right. So.
Yeah. I hope I have everything. This goes. That recorder. Actually, could you grab that recorder? That belongs to the lady who's moving that.
Yep. Did you have all the rest?
I think I've got everything else.
Okay.
Something I have on my notes.
Yeah.
So I hope that wasn't too incoherent.
No, definitely not. I mean, even if
I ended up with nothing but the list of the books.
Well, that's what I felt. Yeah. He's only up to half the list.
Right.
So,
did she say E or?
Not there.
I would never have moved on.
I don't know where I am.
I think this is just A through C, okay. So you probably switch to the whole other side. Or to the left, I guess.
We'll see again.
Have you been here for the whole conference?
Yeah, but I skipped a lot of stuff because I was finishing up this presentation.
Yeah. What have you thought of the general tone?
I don't think I can say it, to be honest. Yeah, I haven't heard enough.
Did you meet a lot of people?
No, this is going to be much better. I'm not laid back.
You got the face?
Yes, I was actually moving this. This was on the other side.
You know what? Might be better to move it over to here.
Okay, yep.
Because it may obscure the... And then I can play the piano.
That's right.
Okay. I feel people are getting bored.
Not next time we can do a musical.
It was a little warm. Yeah. I was basically ignoring everything, trying to get through. Here's your recorder, by the way. Here's your recorder.